We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey, everyone. Before we get into today's pod, I want to tell you about Blue Wire Hustle, a brand new program where you can host your very own podcast here at Blue Wire. Hustle was created to give everyone the opportunity to take your podcast to the next level. Or if you want to host a podcast and just don't know where to start, Hustle's the perfect place for you. As part of the program, you'll receive your personal cover art, Q&As with Blue Wire's top podcasters, access to our community Discord, and an e-learning course full of tips and tricks. And on top of that, we'll help you get your show pushed out to Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, and all their listening platforms. And the best part is, you can get all of this for just $15 a month, the same rate as any other hosting site would charge you just for the initial setup. So whether you're starting from scratch or have an existing show that you want to grow, Hustle is an open door to leveling up your sports experience. Acceptance into the program is limited, so get your application in today. Go to bwhustle.com/join. Check out the description box for this episode to find out more. That's bwhustle.com/join.
Welcome to In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots Podcast. We're your hosts, Shamit Dua and Mason Ginsburg, and this is All Pelicans All the Time. Welcome to In the Know, brought to you by betonline.ag and Indeed. Mason, my friend, it has been such a long time since we've talked, and in that time, this season is lost. Not because of Bledsoe. Griff didn't reinforce the bench. Failure and lottery odds were always the goal.
Oh man. It really has been a long time then, huh?
Yeah, man. I mean, if you didn't know, the season is lost because it's been four games.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess we can pack this in then, and we'll see after the pandemic ends, and we'll have a new year.
Yeah. As a surprise to our fans, this is actually a draft pod. And we're going to be discussing Cade Cunningham and Evan Mobley and Jonathan Kuminga. Mason, do you know any of these names?
Absolutely not. Okay. Absolutely not.
Cool. Well, you know, the early returns on those okay, I'm not even going to go into that. But yeah, man, welcome back. It looks like Pel's Twitter is in mid-season form. And it was quite an eventful night last night due to it. I mean, anytime you get blown out by the Suns, yeah. You got to have a meltdown. I don't know if we fired everyone yet, but we should. And yeah, man, it's been an interesting four games where the Pelicans are 2-2, which is, I think, a better start than they've had any year in the Gentry era, except for that one year they started 4-0 and then Anthony Davis got traded.
And like they look at the teams they've played. And fine, like Toronto obviously has had a rough start. They're 0-3 or 0-4, but you know, they played the Raptors on the road. Granted, it was kind of a road game for the Raptors too, given that they're playing in Tampa this year. Then the in Miami on Christmas, then a home game against the Spurs, and then they go to Phoenix. Like, these are all teams. Like, if there's a game you think they got to get, it's the Spurs. And even that's, you know, that's never a sure thing as long as Greg Popovich is in charge over there. And so, like, I think 2-2 is a reasonable outcome, and probably, like, I think what I would have expected over the first four games, given how little time we had for the offseason, for training camp, for all this, for come together with some new faces, I think 1.5 wins was probably where I would have where I would have placed my bet for the first four games. So you'd think people may be a little bit happier with the result of 2-2, but it seems like the world's on fire right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's hilarious. The Pelicans have played 3 road games to 1 home game, and so who knows if home court advantage is any kind of a consideration in this weird COVID fanless / small fan base era. But there still is that travel component, and I'd wager that role players play better at home. Still, we'll see if that comes to fruition this year and what's going on. But yeah, I mean, the Pelicans role players have been a disaster, to say the least. I mean, if you're not Zion Williamson, if you're not Brandon Ingram, and if you're not Steven Adams, like, no one really knows what you're getting out of that person on a night-to-night basis. And even then, like, you know, Zion's been – he hasn't been, like, all NBA Zion. You know, he's been good. Mm-hmm. He hasn't been that Zion. And so all things considered, like, 500 is an okay place to be. And I think a lot of it's funny to me that, you know, we put out all these polls – before the season, yeah, and in each poll be like, okay, well, where do you expect the Pels to be win total wise, where do you expect the Pels to be seeding wise, etc., etc., and consistently people overwhelmingly responded, oh, we expect them to be 500 or below, or slightly below 500, and you know, they'd be a play-in team, 10th or 9th seed. Very few people outright predicting, you know, a winning season, a guaranteed playoff spot. Very few people. And then here we are, 500 at pace to do these things that everyone expected. And as you said, the world is on fire and we are playing for lottery odds. And I guess that's the beauty of fandom, right? You live in the moment. You get riled up. If things go bad, you get riled up. If things go good. And so, you know, more power to people who like to watch it that way and subject themselves to that. There's no right or wrong way to do this, so knock yourself out.
Yeah, and well, I think some people will be happy because after the Suns game last night, I think they fired Alvin Gentry again. So,
which is, I think that's a funny conversation to have, because, you know, it was fire Alvin Gentry. He doesn't run any plays. He doesn't run any sets, and yet.
No effort. Players don't want to play for him. All that stuff.
Well, I mean, I'm talking mostly about the offense here, right? And the offense is dramatically worse on many counts. And even if you don't look at it from a results standpoint, from a process standpoint, you know, the Pelicans are passing way less. They were the second best passing team in the league last year. They're passing way less, which is, again, a product of limiting the turnovers, which they haven't done a great job of limiting the turnovers at all. It's again, we talked about last year how this is a low IQ team, and I think that is probably still true, but it's also a low-skill team, and I think those things go hand in hand. And so, yeah, they're passing a lot less. They're driving a lot less. You tweeted out that they're generating a lot less assisted looks from threes. I tweeted out that they're generating a lot less open looks from threes. They generated only 8 wide open threes last night. 8. The best team in the league at generating these things generates well over 20. I think it was, hold on 1 second. The best team in the league generates 23.7. The worst team in the league, the Magic, at generating these shots, not record wise, they generate 10 and a half. So this is below the worst. And it's, that's just bad offense. They can't generate any good looks. They're not moving the ball. They're driving the ball a lot less, which is to be expected when you move Drew Holiday. I mean, I think the expectation was that Eric Bledsoe could fill that gap a little bit, apply a little bit of rim pressure. He has not been good. He's been terrible outside of that first game. He had a pretty key game-winning block against DeRozan when they played the Spurs, and defensively he's been adequate and fine. But yeah, it's been a disaster on offense for him. It's been a disaster on offense for anyone not named Brandon Ingram or Zion mm-hmm. Williamson.
Yeah, and look, I mean, you and I both be quick to say that this Pelicans team was not, we didn't expect the world from them from a 3-point shooting perspective. They were top 10 last year. There were a lot of caveats noted on that Zion didn't play a lot. So if you're replacing him with Melly, even though Melly was not that good last year, 3-point shooting. So it's kind of a farce, but yeah, you know, there was a lot of reasons to expect they're not going to be top 10 this year with the trade-offs they've made over the offseason. But still, like, you've got to be able to generate open looks to have a chance at making 3-point shots. And so you can talk to me all you want about how you don't think the Pelicans have enough shooters, but like, if you can't get those guys good looks, I mean, beyond like JJ Redick, who can, you know, make a three with his eyes closed, with his hand in his face, there's like that. I mean, you need to be able to create space for these guys. And so if you're not scared of the Pelicans attacking and anyone besides Ingram or even Zion to an extent being like the second most likely guy to drive and try to make defenses collapse on you, then if I'm a defender, like, what do I care about? You know, I'm going to stick to people on the perimeter until you force me to think about defending differently. And that's kind of I think that's the bigger problem than saying need more shooters, you know?
Yeah. Like I said, there has to be a procedural improvement that generates the type of quality shots the Pelicans need. Every team in the league is going to be trying to limit their efficiency, and the Pelicans' strength is clearly in the paint and at the rim. And so far they've faced three teams that have purposely created a wall for Zion and everyone else and dared the Pelicans to beat them from outside. And you know, they won two of those games, and one of them they shot lights out, and then they haven't shot lights out ever again. And they kind of won on the strength of their quote unquote defense against the Spurs. But, you know, you have those three coaches, Nurse, Spoelstra, and Popovich, that are the masters at creating defenses geared for guys like LeBron, guys like Giannis. And so Zion is nothing new in terms of where he wants to get shots up at. And so that's what they did, and they made the Pels' life difficult. But the Suns aren't that. You know, Monty is a really good coach, and the Suns are a really good team, but they aren't the type to completely wall off the paint. And so the Pelicans needed to be better, and their guard play needed to be better to generate those looks. And it's disappointing that they only got 8 wide open threes against the Suns. And so I think let's talk about a couple things here. There is a lot to unpack with what's going on. We've been kind of talking about the negatives. Let's talk about some positives here. Two positives that I want to point out. One, Brandon Ingram looks fantastic. You know, he's coming back from that max contract and he's nailing his jumpers. He's passing like a madman. Yeah, I mean, there's been some slips in terms of turnovers. His turnover rate is still less than last year's, I believe. Maybe it changed over last night. But he looks like he's taking another step to becoming a more complete player. That is a positive to me. The second positive, which I think is important for the long-term health of this franchise, is absolutely no minutes restrictions on Zion. He's had a couple games where he's already played 38 minutes twice. So two big wins there in terms of the franchise players. And I think that's an important takeaway.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that in particular speaks to the broader way in which I'm kind of approaching the season. And I know it's hard to do that. And this also gets back to your comment around everyone before the season, everyone's like, yeah, probably 500-ish team. And now they're 2-2, there's chaos. But it's really about the fact this isn't about this season. And I know it's hard to hear that. And I know, especially as a Pelicans fan, when you feel like you hear that every single year.
It's
like
about lottery odds, Mason. The season is lost.
but no, I mean, it's really about, it's about the long-term prospects of this team and its path to being, a title contender or at least like a deep playoff team. And so that's not this season. But when you talk about those two factors you just mentioned and Brandon Ingram taking another step in his game and Zion Williamson, who's still a kid, but is second on the team in minutes, just right behind BI, playing, like you said, no restrictions. Like those are foundational elements for the long term. Like I don't care as much about Eric Bledsoe's last three games being trash when we're thinking about the bigger picture. It changes your perspective. And so yeah, there are a lot of problems right now, but I think that the bigger picture is that the guys you want to see thriving and you want to see healthy have given you no reasons to be more concerned than you were before the season. I mean, and I'm feeling much better about it. So yeah, I totally agree. It's important to keep that perspective when things don't go well like they did against Phoenix.
Yeah, absolutely. And so since we touched on that and you mentioned they haven't given you more to be concerned about, I do want to bring up Zion in the overall conversation because it seems like there has been a lot of discussion driven by one of the friends of the pod, Michael McNamara, in terms of what his future looks like and what he may be. Is there a part of you that's disappointed in where he's at physically and how that relates to the effort he puts forth on the court, especially on the defensive end?
I think it's too early. And like, I get the sentiment, but also I like to have fun. And so I'm trying not to dwell on negatives too much for a guy who's played like 30 games so far in his career. And he's had anything. And this applies, and I'm sure we'll talk about Jack too, but this applies to him too. And all the rookies from last season, it's like, rookies out of college, I should say. I'm not giving the same benefit of the doubt to Melly, but it's been a weird first, 12 to 18 months in the NBA for these guys. I mean, you go from, especially with Zion, was starting the season with an injury, comes back and will not had a great summer league, had a great preseason, then kind of hit a brick wall and didn't get to play much. And so all these guys faced unique circumstances from the start, and it got exacerbated obviously during the pandemic. There's a bubble. And then you come back to your second year after what seems like a 3-hour off season, no training camp or limited training camp. And you just got so little time to put all the pieces together. And there's a learning curve here that has been increased by the nature of the past, year or so. And so if you're going to point out things that are cause for concern, I'm not here to say that you're wrong. I'm just, I need more data. I need to see a little bit more before I start to hit the panic button. So that's kind of where I stand.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very reasonable take. And I think I've already voiced my long-term concerns with Zion and Brandon Ingram in terms of building a team that's competent defensively around those two guys, because neither have been fantastic. It's too early to tell if either of them taken a meaningful step forward this season. I do think the activity from Brandon Ingram has been increased. I don't know what that's going to look like 40 games in, especially if the season goes south. That's something to watch for. But I remain optimistic that if he continues this level of activity, that it's not a horrendous liability. And it gives you a little bit more flexibility with what you can do with those lineups. But as far as Zion, I think you hit the nail on the head that it's been a really tough adjustment for the young player. And to me, it looks like he just has he doesn't know what it takes to be at an all NBA or MVP level in the NBA yet. And that is, again, a product of playing less than 30 games, being as young as he is, and just not having experience like that. And I think JJ Redick mentioned on his pod at one point, like, Zion hasn't established his routine yet in terms of what works for him and gets him ready on a night-to-night basis. And I think once he figures out that part, things will start to slow down for him and he'll get better. I do think that there needs to be a continued and strong emphasis on his physical conditioning, which if he's able to play 38 minutes, I think that is already a massive improvement. I think he looks a lot better mobility wise than he did in the bubble, given such a short turnaround. And so optimistically, it looks even better next offseason if, you know, health permitting. And so I have fewer long-term concerns. And again, no knock on anybody that is let down or feels like, you know, maybe Zion won't end up being that guy. Hey man, you're entitled to your opinion. There's certainly, you know, reasons to believe that given what we've seen, but I'm with you. I need more data.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess, should we, do you want to take this to the other, to the next rookie big man that are from last year's big man and talk about that? Or you want to save that?
I mean, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. So,
go for it.
Yeah, so there's you referenced the lack of contributions from role players. That's and you know, we've got Zion healthy and playing big minutes. We got BI looking awesome, and beyond that, we should probably talk about Steven Adams because I think he's been he's made me happy so far with his contributions. But I mean, beyond that, it's been tough, and Jackson Hayes and Melly, for that matter, have been two of the big causes of concerns from folks, just because the Pelicans have kind of been a disaster when Steven Adams has left the floor. And there's been a lot of pointing at, I'll talk maybe Hayes a little bit more specifically, because this is the key question to me. It's less about Melly. Like I'm quickly falling off the train with him, and I don't really see him having a future with the team beyond this year, or, you know, being a guy who's a regular rotation player. But Hayes is a question mark, right? I think people are disappointed that they haven't seen growth from him, from last year to this year, again, after four games. And I think there may be almost an unfair level of expectations being put on Jax, just because there's so few options elsewhere for the Pelicans to go in these situations. I mean, I promise you, if there was someone who was legitimately better than Jackson Hayes there to get minutes in the front court, Sam Van Gundy isn't going to mess around, and he's going to give that player minutes. But you know, I do feel a little bad for Jax, just because of everything I mentioned with Zion's case for him too, in terms of how his first year has gone and the limited time he's had to really have an off season and create and improvements in his game. But it's, I do think the reaction to Jax has been a little bit unfair. In that he's just, I don't think he's like other 20-year-olds who have been playing basketball for their entire lives. And like, not to say that Jax hasn't played in some form, but he wasn't a basketball player, like and made that his focus until like high school. And he just hasn't played for very long, and he's not there, the development curve, the way that some other players might be at his age. And so, if you want to bash Griff or whoever for taking him eighth, and that he shouldn't have been drafted that high, you know, that's fine. I think it's crazy to just close the book on him and just say, it's not going to happen. Like, four games into a second year, I haven't seen any improvement, so let's just shut it down and move on. Like, that, maybe it hasn't been quite that extreme, but it seems like that's been the general sentiment from a lot of people, frustrated that he hasn't shown more improvement. And like, I get the frustration, but at the same time, the Pelicans don't really have any other places to turn behind Steven Adams, which is a whole other discussion unto itself. So, I mean, let's just, can we wait a little bit before we're judging this kid and what his NBA career might look like? I mean, I think you may even be better to speak to this than me, because you're buying all the Jackson Hayes stock over the offseason. And so I'm curious what your perspective is on him after four games and if it's changed.
Yeah, I mean, do you feel like our pod gets boring sometimes because we agree too much?
Yes, but we'll get to Lonzo soon. I feel like we can start to we can maybe start to talk a little bit more about disagreeing on that. But here, let's go with Jack.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, look, I think you summed it up really well with regards to having patience on Jackson. But I do want to touch on one point. Look, he's playing 9 minutes per game, right? And he's playing 9 minutes per game on primarily bench units that have zero shot creation on them. So imagine if he is on last year's Oklahoma City Thunder, or, you know, if he is on the Clippers, right? And he has Dennis Schroeder from last year's Thunder running like 10 pick and rolls with him, or Lou Williams running 10 pick and rolls for him. And because that's who Jackson Hayes is as a player right now, right? He's a pick and roll finisher. He's a lob threat. He's a roll man. He's extremely athletic big, and his gifts aren't being utilized in that front because the way the Pelicans are currently using him is a 1.5 million dribble handoffs with JJ Redick, which is designed to get JJ shots. And that's important because JJ, you need to get JJ going. He can swing games if he's on fire. And he's been in a slump since that first game, but it takes away from Jackson's game because in order to have a successful dribble handoff, it's very similar to running a pick and roll. You need a component where you can utilize the roll man, right? And JJ, if he gets the handoff, he is not big enough to pass over defenders and hit Jackson on that roll. And also the Pelicans bench is just so bad that, you know, the teams can load up on Jackson rolling to the rim because they know that guy, like, there's no one making that swing pass to the weak side corner. And even if they manage to get that pass off, like, that guy's not going to hit that shot. We're going to live with it. And so I think Jackson would do much better on a team where his role was simplified as a pick and roll man. And I think, you know, that's part of why I want to see more Nikhil minutes. I want to see more Kyra minutes. Nikhil has shown chemistry with Jackson running that pick and roll. And it's not a complicated offense. It's just a high screen and roll. And I think it leads to good shots because Nikhil, unlike some other guards on this team, actually makes a concerted effort to drive to the rim, warp the defense a little bit, draw two. Because if Nikhil is drawing two, and someone's helping off of Jackson, that's an easy dump off pass or an easy lob. And so that's kind of the environment Jackson needs to thrive in. And I guarantee you, if the Pelicans had elite guard play or competent guard play for that matter, he would look like a much different player. And it doesn't apply just to Jackson. It applies to Melly, who I think would get cleaner catch and shoot looks if they had a guy like that. It applies to Hart, who I think would get more corner threes. It would apply to JJ, who would get more, he would finally get catch and shoot looks that aren't him running off a million screens and trying his damnedest to get open. Cause teams know, like, hey, that's really the only shot the Pelicans can generate on the bench. And so they sit on that, pass and they swarm JJ and then they force the ball out of his hands. So it's a pretty easy action to defend if the other guys aren't doing anything. And so, you know, I was hoping that putting Bledsoe and staggering Bledsoe with those units would create some of that, where you just spam the pick and roll with him and Jackson and you live with whatever the results come. But for whatever reason, whether it's Bledsoe not taking the initiative to do it, whether it's Stan calling different plays and making it more JJ oriented, or the players just not having the chemistry, they're not doing that, right? I feel like that's an easy pathway to a good off or an okay offense and getting easy buckets for these guys. But they're not doing that. And so I think guys like Jackson can look way better if they have way better guards. Like if you put him on a team with James Harden right now, you know, James Harden was making Nene at like 40 years old look good. Tyson Chandler, like 40 years old, look good. Who is that minimum player that I love that the Nuggets just signed? Isaiah Hartenstein. You know, like, those guys are going to thrive next to a guard that can draw two and draw attention and get to the rim and get easy buckets. And that's who Jackson is, who I think he's made improvements in other areas. His rebounding rate has improved. His block and steal rates are better. His assist rates are better this year. I think he's making better contact on screens. It's just, man, the Pelicans leave so much to be desired on the offensive end, specifically on their bench. Like, they need Like if they had oh my God, people are going to hate me for this. If they had like a Spencer Dinwiddie on the bench, if they had a Caris LeVert, on the bench, you know, like there's just one competent ball handler on the bench that can just eat up possessions and your bread and butter is just spamming that pick and roll and creating looks out of it. That's what they need. And I think that kind of carries over to the starting unit as well, because Stan Van Gundy mentioned that Brandon Ingram is having to create more shots for himself than he ever has. And so I think that's absolutely accurate, because he's shooting like 20 something percent from catch and shoot three, and he's not taking all that many of them. And he's shooting like an absurd, like 45% like off the dribble. And he's nailing them. But really, you know, like last year we discovered that catch and shoot Ingram is a deadly weapon, and there's no one on the team to take advantage of that. And same thing with Zion, you know, I agree that getting him reps on the ball and having him initiate is a pathway for him to become a better player. And it's going to make him better next year. Right. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you had a guard who can break down the defense and create that open look, how many easy shots is Zion getting? How many easy pick and roll lobs? Like, has he had like a single pick and roll lob this season? Like, are all of his lobs have basically been in transition or like off a post off or, you know, a broken play. But like, you know, your bread and butter, like if Chris Paul runs a high pick and roll with Tyson Chandler and he gets that lob off the Crescent City connection, like, how many of those situations has Zion had?
That's exactly where you mentioned Tyson Chandler on the Rockets, and I was going to go way back to Tyson Chandler on Pelicans. Like Chris Paul, and Chandler was still young, but Chris Paul legitimately revitalized Tyson Chandler's career. Like he was a high draft pick who really hadn't amounted to too much until he came to New Orleans and look what happened. I mean, like, I think it speaks volumes to putting guys like that in the right situation. Also does a lot for their confidence level and feeling like they belong. And like you run some risks here if you're going to close the book on a guy like Hayes before you really know what he is and what he can be. And look, again, if you get back to if there's a legitimately much better option than Jackson Hayes to be taking those minutes and whatever it is, like you said, he's only played 9 minutes a game so far this year, or in like the 10 minutes a game or 12 minutes a game or so you're looking for from him, then yeah, it's good. Like if Gabriel gets active and Stan thinks he's a good option to plug in there and can help the team win games, that'll probably happen, whether he plays for Melly or for Hayes. But I just don't see the need to just jump ship on him right now when there's no good alternative. There just isn't. And so that, like I said, that's a whole other can of worms that we can jump into if we want.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, I agree. And I looked up the stats for the creation stuff. Okay, so on average, you know, what percent of Brandon Ingram's field goals do you think were assisted his first 4 years in the league? It's not a very high percentage because he creates for himself a lot. But on average, what do you think it was?
For BI?
Yeah, BI. His first 4 years.
Just for all shots or just like just three?
All shots. Mm. And then we'll go three.
40%.
Yeah, I mean, close enough. Actually, it's not all shots. It's 2 points. I thought there would be a delineation. But so 34.9% of his two-pointers were assisted his first 4 years in the league. 91.7% of his threes were assisted his first 4 years in the league. Where do you think those numbers are at today, this season?
Well, judging by the Pelicans at large, those numbers have dropped precipitously. I'd imagine he's creating 2/3 of his looks.
Bro, 13.6% of his two-pointers have been assisted.
So like 85%, 90%.
Yes. He's creating like 86% of his looks, which is absurd.
Yeah.
And then from three, so his first 4 years, 91% of them had been assisted, right?
Mm-hmm.
50% of them have been assisted this year.
I mean, a lot of them are just like pull up bailouts, right? Just like, yeah, all right, I mean, I'm
it's
do
a
this.
High screen with Adams or high screen with Zion, and then there's enough separation, and he lets it fly, which is amazing. I think that's the next evolution in his game, and I think that's going to help Zion a lot on a better fitting roster. It's going to help the whole team because that's where the NBA is heading. You need to be able to hit that pull up three. And the Pelicans didn't have that guy. And if Ingram turns into Zach Lowe likes to call it a capital S shooter off the dribble there, then, you know, that's a problem. That is a deadly weapon. And so I'm all for Ingram letting those things fly. I should continue to let those things fly, but you know, that's kind of the dire state that the Pelicans are in terms of shot creation. And so to bring it back to Jackson Hayes, like, yes, he's been disappointing. But the environment just hasn't been anything to lead him to be better than he should be. I mean, he looked better last year because the Pelicans had way more guard play and way more and more spacing and way more shooting, and they played at a faster pace. You know, they're playing to his strengths. And if you want to turn him into, I can't even think of a good example, but like just a dribble handoff guy, then you know, that's really mitigating his actual skill set. And so I am optimistic that he gets a lot better. It's very possible that he does not live up to the bill of an eighth pick. I think, you know, at this point people would say it's realistic that he doesn't live up to, like, he's probably not going to be the eighth best player. I'm still high on him. I still think that he can be a pretty impressive force defensively. And I think offensively he can be a problem in the right system. So we'll see. A lot of growth left for him to do, especially from a body development standpoint. This was supposed to be his rookie year. He was not supposed to play last year effectively. And so that's another lens to keep in mind. But, you know, he's just one of many Pelicans that have been disappointing this season, to say the least.
The NBA is back in action, and football is heading to the playoffs. You might not be at a game this year, but you can still be in on the action at BetOnline. BetOnline is going the extra mile to make sure you can get on every possible chance to win this season. From game spreads and totals to team, player, and coaching props, BetOnline gives you more options to wager than anywhere else. You can get in on their season opening bonuses today and start wagering on wins, division, and championship features all day, every day. Head to BetOnline today and take advantage of all the great sign-up bonuses. Don't forget to use promo code BLUEWIRE at betonline.ag. That's BLUEWIRE, all one word. BetOnline, your online sportsbook expert.
2020 has reshaped how we work, and it's almost over. Businesses across the globe are challenged to be their most efficient, which means every hire is critical. Indeed is here to help. Indeed is the number one job site in the world, with more total visits than any other job site, according to ComScore. Indeed helps you find quality candidates quickly, so you can focus on hiring the person you need to keep your business going. Unlike other sites, Indeed gives you full control and payment flexibility over your hiring. You only pay for what you need, you can pause your account at any time, and there are no long-term contracts. And now, Indeed's new way of matching you with candidates instantly delivers a short list of quality candidates whose resumes and Indeed match your job criteria that you can contact the moment you sponsor a job, making Indeed the only job site that can move as fast as you do. Right now, Indeed is offering our listeners a free $75 credit to boost your job post, which means more quality candidates will see it fast. Try Indeed out with a free $75 credit at Indeed.com/BlueWire. This is their best offer available anywhere. Go right now to Indeed.com/BlueWire. Offer valid through December 31st. Terms and conditions apply.
So who's next? Bledsoe?
I mean, there's always time to talk about Lonzo on the pod.
Oh, man. Well, all right, let's go there. So Lonzo, I mean, I'm struggling a lot with his season this year, and not because I think he's been bad, it's because I don't know how to. I'm struggling to evaluate it, and because, like, I think Lonzo's done a lot of things well. I think the things he hasn't done well, the things he's always not really done well, but it's things that the team needs more this year, and so, like, it's more pronounced that he hasn't done them well. But, like, on the flip side, I think he's been one of the team's best defenders over the first four games. I think he's clearly taken a step up there, whereas a lot of it last year was just the reputation more than the actual results. But I think he's doing better defensively. He's been a key to their success on that end so far. But I just feel like on offense, I'm not saying you can rave about how the pull-up jumper is a game changer for him all you want, but like I don't think it is, and I don't see a much different Lonzo Ball on the offensive end, which again is fine depending on what you want from him and again what you think he's worth next summer, because that's critical. But who he is and what the skills the Pelicans lack, I feel like it's more pronounced now, and it could get uglier in certain cases as the season goes on. But again, that's not necessarily Lonzo's fault as much as it is a roster building. So roster building issue in the short term. What have you seen from him relative to what you were expecting or hoping to see so far?
Yeah, I mean, I think I wrote about this right before the season started, that we need to see consistency out of him. We can't have a Lonzo that is hot and cold. One night he looks like a star, the other night he looks like his bubble version. And so far, that's exactly what we've seen. He had a good game against the Raptors. He was knocking down a lot of shots, especially from three. And I think there was one quarter, the third quarter specifically, where he turned it around against the Raptors. Likewise, with the Spurs, again, in the third quarter, he really turned it around. So really, he's had two really impressive quarters of play on the offensive end. Outside of that, it's been a lot of, where are you, dude? I don't feel your presence. You're not really generating that many assists at the moment. You're still leading the team in touches. So I don't want to hear the excuse of, oh, they're not giving him the ball. No, he's leading the team in touches. He's not generating that many assists, and it's not like there's a lot of potential assists that he's leaving on the table. That's not the case either. He has more rebounds than assists. He's driving even less than last year, which is problematic. I was hoping to see perhaps a step up in that direction. The improvement is that he's feeling confident to take that off the dribble mid-range shot, and he's hit 5 of 6 so far. I don't think that's sustainable, but it may be a pathway to some points for him and his ability to impact the game. But again, that if you're taking like two a game, maybe one a game, defenses are not going to care, especially if it's a long two. So there's still, it's a work in progress. It's a encouraging sign that he's taking that. He's used the glass a couple times really well. Shows a good understanding of angles. That's encouraging. It's not anywhere near the stage where defenses care or that's going to meaningfully help the Pelicans. But again, it's a work in progress. So my biggest thing was, I don't want to see hot and cold Lonzo. We have seen hot and cold Lonzo on the offensive end. As you mentioned, his defense has been spectacular. There's no other word for it. It's been spectacular. He's been fighting over screens, which I thought was a big issue last year. He wasn't getting over screens a lot. He's been playing the passing lanes a lot. It seems like the Pelicans have given him the Drew Holiday responsibility of defending the best perimeter player, which is fantastic. I think we'll see what that looks like when they play a team that has some dynamic wings of Brandon Ingram size. But so far, he's been spectacular on that end. So no complaints on the defensive end. Just need some offensive consistency in any capacity. And then kind of going back to our previous point about like shot creation. One thing I feel like people don't realize with Lonzo is, his arguable best scoring skill. I mean, it's not argue, it's inarguable. His best scoring skill, period, is the catch and shoot three. And if they had a dynamic guard, and this is a little bit on Bledsoe and some of the other shot creators on the team, but if they had a dynamic guard like Drew Holiday or someone better that can create easy catch and shoot threes for Lonzo, he would look a lot better. And to be fair, like Lonzo hasn't hit his threes, and I expect that to come around a little bit, because I don't think he is a 28.6% three-point shooter. I don't think JJ is a 29% three-point shooter. But it hasn't been good offensively at all.
Yeah. It's been, it's certainly very frustrating. And like, I thought Bledsoe wouldn't be I didn't think he'd be Drew level, but I thought he would be able to give the Pelicans like enough of what Drew did off the dribble and pick and rolls and, you know, in terms of getting to the rim that would, you know, help Lonzo continue the success he showed last season, inconsistencies aside, but it hasn't happened. And I really don't know. I guess part of it is like, we got to pump the brakes on the Bledsoe criticisms because it's new. He's new to the team and being a quote unquote lead guard, you know, when you haven't really had time to get integrated, should be less of an issue for Bledsoe because he's a vet, but still challenging. And so, yeah, I mean, I feel like it's not like Lonzo has been perfectly set up for success on the offensive end either. So, I mean, it's a lot of things that come to a head together. But again, I think your point about consistency is well taken. It's something that, you know, he needs to show if he wants to, you know, be a guy who gets that next contract that, you know, is going to give him what he wants.
Yeah, I mean, so that's the concerning aspect, right? So Markel Fultz, who's been spectacular himself, he's averaging like 20 points a game, on the Magic, who've been a pretty good team so far. You know, he got a 3 years, $50 million extension. Derek White, 4 years, $73 million, something like that. Again, these guys are getting between $16 to $19 million a piece, right? And there's no reason for Lonzo to accept anything less than that because they're comparable players at best, I think. At worst, at best, you know, Lonzo's just way better than they are, because, you know, he's a dynamic playmaker, in transition, rebounder, defender, all the above, et cetera. And so if you're a clutch, you're going into the restricted free agency, like, look, these guys got paid. Lonzo wants to get paid. And so the conversation, the numbers I heard got thrown around, you know, they believe that they could get more than Fred VanVleet got, which I don't want to pay a guy that you don't know what you're going to get from a night to night basis, Fred VanVleet money. That's, you know, $22 million a year. I can't get behind that. And so the Pelicans need to figure out what they have with him. This is going to upset his portion of the fan base, but, you know, I said before the season started, and this is going to be my default state going forward, is that the Pelicans should look to move on from him. And that's going to be my default state until he plays well enough to swing me from that position. And I think moving on from him just gives opportunity to the other guys who the Pelicans also need to figure out what they are. They need to figure out who Nikhil is. They need to figure out what Kyra is. And they got time, you know, there's no rush, but, you know, I don't want them to be in a situation where it's the summer and you got hot and cold Lonzo for the whole year. And then someone throws him, you know, like $18, $19, $20 million a year. The Knicks do it or someone else does it. And you're like, well, do I match? And then, if he signs that offer sheet, first of all, you know, your cap is tied for 3 days. And then if he doesn't sign it, you're like, okay, well, do I let him walk for nothing? This is a terrible place to be. It's kind of like where the Kings were with Bogdanovich, and that's why they tried desperately to sign and trade him, and which is again another option in the summer. But I would rather avoid all that mess and just move forward. We'll see. You know, long season ahead, and 4 games is absolutely nothing to make a decisive decision on, and there's still ample opportunity for him to get better.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if we disagree on this, but it's probably the closest thing we've gotten to on this podcast so far. But I'm at this point, I'm firmly in the camp of wanting to wait it out and wait until something close to the trade deadline to even think about moving Lonzo. I mean, like, I want to get as much more data as I can because I still don't feel like his value is enough on the open market to really trade him for anything of value, unless. The one caveat to that is that, and it's a problem that Pelicans created on their own, unless you're trying to do something that improves the roster in another way, since they're so close to the tax line, if you're trying to shed and upgrade elsewhere in a move that you can kind of make a short-term and long-term argument for, like I certainly don't want to move Lonzo to make a additional effort at the 2021 playoffs that doesn't really think about anything beyond that. But I feel like I'm still seeing enough from him in different areas of his game to definitely want to keep him until the last possible moment at the trade deadline and see what the offers are and see what you think he's going to command and the role he's filled in with the Pelicans. So I am. It seems like you're in the mind of let's move him sooner rather than later and just kind of like give those minutes to others. I would like to see more before I make that move.
Yeah, I mean, I think the point I want to push back on was, you know, you saying you don't want to move him for nothing. And I think, you know, there's value in freeing up minutes. I think there's value in having a clear picture of your roster moving forward. So to me, that's not nothing. And that's the only thing I wanted to chime in on. And I'm sure you don't disagree on that. But that's
not at all. Yeah. I mean, like trading him for, you know, maybe a little bit less than what you think his value is and justifying it by saying we're giving those minutes to Nikhil or to Kyra. Like I get the rationale there. So yeah, with you.
Cool. And so moving on, but kind of on a similar notice, this has been a question that's been asked to us a lot and we'll have a separate question and answer pod, but because we talked about Lonzo, it's only right that we talk about his partner in crime, Josh Hart, who he got engaged. Congratulations to Josh Hart. Very interesting engagement picture comments that are online. If you haven't seen them, check them out.
Did you hear what Jen Hale said about the engagement on the broadcast yesterday?
No, what did she say?
Oh, it wasn't a joke. I thought it was really cool that he used all local vendors for everything he did for the engagement. So like everything it's like a hard thing to do. Cause there's a lot of talent in New Orleans, but I thought it was cool that he's like, you know, he made sure to have to do every part of the engagement that he needed to get, you know, outside help for was done with folks from New Orleans, which is pretty neat.
Man, that is really impressive. And that leads really nicely into the point I wanted to make about him. How upset should we be? Like, you know, chaining ourselves to the facility, the practice facility, because we did not give him a lifetime contract extension.
I don't know how to respond to that. I wasn't sure where you were going with that question, but that's definitely not where I thought you were going.
Okay, but let's talk about that extension seriously, right? So, you know, Lonzo didn't get extended, which again, reasonable for both sides, given the contract demands, and Josh Hart didn't get extended. And there were a fair number of people worried, concerned, upset, et cetera, that Josh Hart did not get extended. Where were you at on that?
My perspective changed throughout the day. It was a very interesting day, right? Because you saw the contract after contract come out and you started playing it forward. It's like, these agents and these teams are seeing all these, you know, marquee free agents get re-signed by their existing teams. And so where is this money going to go? And I think teams started freaking out and started, you know, acquiescing to player demands a little bit on contract amounts. And so I think what my gut tells me is the Pelicans didn't want to rush and make a decision without feeling totally comfortable with it. And I think that I would be very surprised if not very surprised, but I would be surprised if Josh Hart does not re-sign with New Orleans, but I'm not heartbroken that they didn't get a deal done with him before the deadline, just because I think the numbers are getting pretty high for similar players to Josh. So like, I think that, it would have been the best, the hindsight 2020 move is to work out a deal with him earlier on in the process before these contracts started getting handed out. But also the Pelicans had their own order of operations they had to consider regarding the moves with Drew and Stephen Adams and all that. And so like I'm sure they were still trying to figure out what their next couple of years would look like too. And from a cap sheet perspective.
And so, you know, the intel I got that was that there was conversations with him and there were good conversations. And I think ultimately, again, is one of those situations where both sides determined that it would be best to just address it at a different date. I think it's important for the Pelicans to not lock themselves into long-term money, as you said, and overpay for someone. And I think, you know, I get the concern of a team swooping in and just throwing a massive contract at Josh Hart. Well, if they do that, great, more power to them. I think he's a solid player and a player that this team needs culturally, and then he fills a good amount of gaps. But it's not one of those things where I'm trying to say this without like being insulting, but it's like, you know, he's not a massive needle mover per se, in the sense that, like, you know, if someone came in and paid him like someone paid Kent Bazemore a few years ago, you know, you let that Kent Bazemore walk every single time, because you don't want to pay $18 million to Kent Bazemore, who's a fine player. He does a lot of the same things that Josh Hart does. And that's just a situation you should avoid, especially when, you know, teams find guys like Royce O'Neal or Danwell House, or the Raptors find, you know, guys like this all the time. And so I think that locking yourself into a massive deal would be a mistake. And I'm not too concerned about someone overpaying him. I really don't think teams, you know, like it, I just mentioned Royce O'Neal, like who came in clamoring for Royce O'Neal? No one. Right. Or, you know, maybe they extended him. Maybe he never hit free agency. The point is, you know, he got paid like $8 million a year. I think it was like a 4-year, $32 to $36 million deal, basically MLE money at that time. And then he's been with the Jazz. And I think that's kind of what Josh Hart's market will be. And, you know, at max, I'll be fine paying him Solomon Hill money, which was like 4 years, 48. But nothing more than that. And I really don't think someone's going to raise the price up that much.
Interesting. Even I'm a little bit more concerned, I guess, than you are. Just seeing numbers for guys like Derek White and
I think the market's different for PGs than it is for like swings who are okay. And you know, like he's not a fantastic shooter. He's only shooting 30% from three, which again goes back to the whole Pels aren't generating easy shots discussion. He's a tremendous rebounder, right? And he's averaging 7.5 rebounds per game this year, but you know, he's not a needle mover on offense. And needle movers on offense are what get paid, in my opinion, not grunt guys.
That explains what Kuzma got. So
understood. Yeah, I mean, so like, you know, here's his career: 7.9 points per game, 7.8 points per game, 10 points per game last year, 8.3 points per game. Again, you're going to get 8 to 10 points out of this guy every night, and maybe one night, you know, you get a lot more, but teams really historically don't overpay for that unless you're Dell Demson. really don't historically overpay for that. And so my concern level is a lot lower on him. And I do think that he will be a Pelican for quite some time.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, I guess even, you know, when I saw not just White, but also Luke Kennard get the money he got, but also like, I think Clippers are in a slightly different position in that, you know, I don't think they're thinking about cap space as much. And also like, they're also looking at Kennard as kind of a point guard.
I think Kennard is good. I think he's just unhealthy. Like, he's not very healthy.
I think it's good too. Yeah.
Yeah. But in, yeah, just rule of thumb, I think offensive players just get paid way more than, like, I think a mediocre offensive player gets paid more than a mediocre defender.
Hmm. Well, fair.
Yeah. So that's where I am with Josh Hart. I feel like we've covered the roster fairly well. And so I do want to trend towards wrapping up the podcast. But a couple things before we do that, we didn't touch on Steven Adams. Thoughts, impressions, emotional outbursts, professions of love.
I mean, he is exactly what I thought he was going to be so far, which is nice, because I feel like it's a lot of Pelican players that haven't quite measured up, other than BI, who's been even better as a playmaker. But yeah, I mean, he's doing all this, you know, I don't know what his impact's been off the floor. Impossible to say this early, but the Pelicans are clearly better when he's on the floor. I think the pairing with Zion, for all the outcries we've heard about spacing, the Pelicans shooting ain't great. We've already talked about that enough, but I think he's, you know, I think the fit is fine to good. And it's really fun to watch them set screens, which is kind of what we expected. We said, you know, we're going to try to counteract the lack of spacing that he provides with the ability to free guys up. I guess he hasn't done as much as I would have hoped on with that screen setting ability, and that the Pelicans are still kind of struggling to get a ton of good open looks. But I think that's more about the other problems this team has than Steven Adams. And so I'm happy with what I've seen, and it's nice to have a big I feel like we can reasonably rely on both ends of the floor, specifically rebounding.
Yeah, I think I'd say he's been more impressive than I thought he would be. I think I was a little bit concerned that his mobility had taken a hit, and you know, he may not be the healthiest because he has a lot of miles on him, and he looks very active. He looks very mobile, and you know, it is an absolute treat watching him on the offensive glass, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a monster of a human being in terms of size, but you know, it's one thing with Zion, who has an absurd second jump and he's just gonna brute force his way into an offensive rebound. This dude's technique is off the charts. The way he like swim moves around people's and spins around people and throws them out of the way, and the way he gets positioning it's a beauty to watch. And so I'm very excited to continue watching that. And again, I feel like everything that we've talked about circles back to the need for creation, because like, if you have a guy that sets screens as well as Steven Adams does, man, don't you wish you had a guy who can take advantage of him consistently? Which I think part of why BI is taking a leap is they are running a lot of actions with those two together, and it's freeing up part of like why BI is shooting like 300 million percent on off the dribble threes, is because Steven Adams sets a monster screen and there's nothing but daylight for Ingram to hit that shot. So I think we've already seen the fruits of Steven Adams screens, and I think they can maybe utilize that in a close game if they need to, if the Pelicans are ever getting that situation. But man, like, you know, OKC, one of the reasons they were so clutch last year, they were like the best team in the clutch, which Chris Paul had a lot to do with that. But one of the reasons Chris Paul looked like the Chris Paul of the old, or he looked like he had, you know, gotten younger, was because Steven Adams would set those massive screens for him, allowing Chris Paul to get downhill into that mid-range spot to get those shots off. And so all I want, and it doesn't have to be this season, you know, all I want on a team for like the future version of the team at some point is a guard who is dynamic and can create for himself and others and can score at more than one level. That is all I want. And very happy Steven Adams is on the team.
Yeah, for sure. And I feel like, I feel like we're getting to a lot of these chicken or the egg discussions around, you know, what's the Pelicans problem? Is it ability to create off the dribble and create shots? Or is it the fact that you can't get into the lane because there's not enough spacing on the floor? And I guess where I keep going back to is that, yes, both are issues, but like I looked recently at the, once Zion came back, and so the front court was predominantly Zion and Favors. So you had two non-shooting bigs on the floor. How many drives per game was Jrue Holiday registering during that period?
A lot.
13. 13. And so I didn't dig into how, you know, what the turnover rate was on those, what the assist rate or, you know, field goal percentage was, but like, if Jrue can do it, there are better players in the league at doing that than Jrue. If Jrue can get into the paint with that level of frequency with two non-shooting bigs on the floor, like, it can be done. This isn't like a Herculean effort. I will like acknowledge that if when BI is the one doing that driving, that exacerbates the problem, because if BI is inherently one of your spacers on the floor, if you're having him drive, then that's just one more shooter that's not spacing the floor for BI, because that is BI driving. And so that's tricky, right? But I think that there are players out there that are good at disrupting defenses, even when you're not flanking that player with shooters all over the floor. So like, it can't, it, 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 it's an issue for New Orleans, but it shouldn't be a crutch or excuse, you know?
Yeah, I agree. And the Pelicans roster is clearly incomplete. And, you know, I know everyone wants to hammer management for that. And I feel like it's just one of those situations where, again, you're well within your right to hammer the management for that. They deserve criticism for building a roster that has the exact same flaws, perhaps magnified, that they did last year. But to me, all it does is it highlights that, yes, they want to be competitive. Yes, they got good players, but there is a much larger picture in play. And it's really tough when games are going on to kind of keep the big picture in mind, especially when you're watching the players stink it up. And so, yeah, that's all I say. Keep that in mind and on to the next game. And hopefully the Pelicans pull out a win and some more wins going forward. And we'll be back at you guys with a question and answer pod real quick. So thanks for listening.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. At hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.